I'm Indy Todd. Welcome to The Point. Today we discuss medical marijuana. Federal law prohibits any use of marijuana, but Massachusetts is one of 22 states that allow medicinal use of the drug. The medical marijuana law in the Commonwealth authorizes doctors to give letters to patients certifying them to use, possess, and grow up to a 60-day supply of the drug, defined by state regulators as 10 ounces. Joining us to talk about the drug and some issues facing doctors is psychiatrist Mark Whaley and psychologist Michael Abrazzese. Good morning to you both.
Good morning, Mindy.
All right, so let's start with some of the basics of what it is and its history. So what is marijuana and what effect does it have on people?
Well, it's a plant, and it has been around for thousands of years. There are three strains of the plant, two of which are in this country, or at least available to us, one called Cannabis indica and the other one called Cannabis sativa. There's a Russian and Eastern European form that I guess we don't see much around here. So it's a plant, and it has chemicals in the plant that look very much and mimic brain chemicals that we have in our brain. And these chemicals have evolved over millions of years so that the system that we call the endocannabinoid system in the brain, fish have it. Other reptiles, other animals have it, and humans have the same system too. And it just so happens that some of the chemicals from this plant, this particular plant, fit the lock and key of the receptors in the brain that are part of this endocannabinoid system. It's named after the plant, actually, although the system developed way before the plant, and the plant is just kind of an accident, more or less, of nature. Evolution didn't give us an endocannabinoid system so we could get high on pot. These are things that occur. But obviously we take advantage of it, just like we take advantage of opioids and alcohol and other things that fit various spots in our brain. So we have an endocannabinoid system. And that system has a lot to do with functions of pleasure, of memory, thinking, cognitive processes. It has a lot to do with rest and digesting. It promotes those functions. It exists in multiple parts of the brain, too, and also the immune system, interestingly enough. So that means that marijuana can have effects on all of those functions I just mentioned, some of which are positive and some of which are pleasurable, and the reason for its popularity.
Okay. So I thought it was really interesting how far back we find descriptions of cannabis.
Yeah.
You're saying thousands of years.
That's right. It's been around a long time, going back 7,000 years. I came across the fact that it was found, 2 pounds of it were found in a mummy that was buried some 2,700 years ago.
Right, in Central Asia. And what was it? I'm trying to think of you had 7,000 cannabis-based textiles dating back to 7,000 BC have been recovered in northern China.
Right,
that's really amazing.
Yeah.
Going back to that mummy, this ancient mummified, it was a shaman. So after scientists conducted extensive testing on the material's potency, they affirmed the most probable conclusion is that this ancient culture cultivated cannabis for pharmaceutical, psychoactive, and divinatory purposes.
Right.
So is used perhaps for medicinal purposes as far back as
back as then, and now we're just making it available.
Yeah. The Principles and Practice of Medicine, first published in 1892, that was Dr. Sir William Osler, and he wrote in regards to the problem of migraine headaches that this was the best treatment. So we do have history of it being used for medicinal purposes.
Yes, going back a long time, and Osler is called the father of modern medicine because of his what he came up with in terms of training doctors and a number of other innovations. He's really the father of modern medicine, and that was his position on treatment for migraines.
Now, of course, most of the science that we have is older, correct?
I mean, it's all old. We have very little what I would call current research, current in the past 5 or 10 years, because of the regulations that the federal government and state governments put on marijuana usage. It was very rare that they were able to get enough money to do research. And as we know, most pharmaceutical companies fund pharmaceutical research. And this is a drug that people believe can be used in 5 or 6 or 7 different areas. But there's really no money at this point to be made in it because the letters that docs give to their patients is just really a certification. It's not a prescription. You can't standardize what they're going to take. Take a plant a day. Everyone has a different kind of potency in the plants that they have. So there's really no way for the pharmaceutical companies to make money on it. Therefore, you're not going to get tons of money involved in research. However, Colorado, which probably has the most liberal law of marijuana in the country, indicated a few days ago that they're going to spend $9 million on rigorous medical marijuana research, but I'm not aware of any other state kicking in that much money for it. Some states kind of don't like the idea about the medical marijuana being popular in their states, but Colorado is the only one that's going to fund money. And that could be because of some of the older findings. The older findings we have for research, and there's not a lot out there, are that most of it is anecdotal. A patient will come in and report something positive, and other studies that are really done are very, very small, fewer than 200 people at most. That's a big study if you had 200 people. And the vast majority of studies, except for one that I was able to review, they only compare the effects of marijuana against a placebo. And as we know, against placebos, well, that's not really where the big money results are. You want to compare it to something else you're using. So is this going to be, for example, for inflammation or for analgesia, is it going to be better than aspirin or ibuprofen or something
right.
like that? So no one has done any research about that.
That's right.
So we're still in the infancy of being able to get valid research supporting that medical marijuana is going to be useful. But as Mark said, the system that it hits in our brain, it has like tendrils that go into so many different areas. You can see why it would be helpful in all those 5 or 6 or 7 areas and why there would be a variable response, because there's no control for the amount of chemicals people have in that area of their cortex anyway. So there's so many intangible variables in there, it's really going to be impossible to come up with really ironclad evidence, probably for a couple of years unless you do longitudinal studies.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, this is really an odd way of getting a medicine into the market, unique and mm-hmm. odd. It's really a political practice of medicine rather than the standard way we go about it in Western medicine.
Well, it's interesting.
Because we've had basically THC pills. We've had the active ingredient pills that are produced by pharmaceutical companies, and
right.
those things are not abused as far as we know. Those things,
That's
there's
right.
no... There's no noise about that like there is about other opioids or other kind of pain relievers that are abused. So we do have it out there, but yep. it does not have the valence as the actual plant usage.
Right. It's approved for two things. One is the nausea associated with chemotherapy. Secondly, it's approved for wasting syndrome. In other words, end-stage cancer situations and HIV disease, AIDS, so that it does, and it does work there. The two drugs are Marinol and Drabinol. Are the two? I'm sorry, I just gave you the name of the same drug. It's Marinol and Nabilone are the two drugs that are approved by the FDA, and so those chemicals have passed muster, so to speak, in terms of developing safety and efficacy standards. Whereas when you use a marijuana plant, you're getting 60 active cannabinoids, 60 different biologically active molecules. And no doctor, at least in Western medicine in their right mind, would prescribe something that has 60 active ingredients without knowing what they are, how much, et cetera.
So the pills that you're talking about, the THC and other these would be synthetic cannabinoids, is that correct?
Yeah, they're synthetic, but they are standardized, and they are available for those two indications. And doctors probably have stuck with those two indications, even though they could be used for anything. That doctors are given that ability to do so. But because of the attitudes about it, there's very little sale of these drugs.
Mm-hmm. And so I'm assuming, because we don't have a lot of research, we don't really know the difference between the synthetics and the actual plant? I mean, you mentioned that there are 60 of these cannabinoids in the plant.
Right. There's no way we know the difference about that because, of just as Mark mentioned, you have so many variables. And so when you give a pill, you expect to take a pill for whatever active ingredient is in there. And one of the arguments that many proponents have for medical marijuana is that it's more holistic to use the entire plant. Mm-hmm. And you have so many variables involved in that plant. You know, you don't know which of those things are a hit and which are going to be a miss. Right. So you take an entire plant. And everyone's going to be using it differently. There's no standardization on that. Right.
Some of the cannabinoids actually counteract one another, too. So you take the whole plant, you're taking some positive, but then you're also getting some negative to that positive.
And there are side effects of this, and we don't know if you take the plant, if something in the plant is causing some of the side effects, or whether it's just the active ingredient, THC, that's causing
exactly.
the side effects.
Yeah. Well, and everything has side effects, right?
Everything has side effects. Everything has side effects. All medicine and even psychotherapy has side effects. That's true. And one of the problems is that we don't know what the side effects are going to be. If someone comes in with a serotonin syndrome, you're pretty sure how that happened. Mm-hmm. Someone comes in with some kind of syndrome that might be attached to the potency of their marijuana plant, it's going to be a long time before docs are going to be able to figure that out because it's going to be such a strange phenomenon.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
Now, the potency between what we have in marijuana plants today, and I don't think we know yet, this 2,700-year-old pot that they found with the mummy, I imagine they're doing some testing on. But when we look at what we have
today. I would say that mummy's in deep trouble.
Yeah, deep trouble. It's more than the 10 ounces that he's supposed to be having. So with the potency, we do have some references to what was around in the 60s and 70s compared to now. It's much more potent now, right?
Right.
Yeah.
That's another complication of the research. A lot of the research where they say that there are a lot of negative side effects with marijuana, that was done before maybe 2002 or 2004. And the potency now in 2010, 12, 14 is much different, much greater than the potency that was used in the sponsorship of the old research. So some of the findings that we had that showed that there was no positive result by using marijuana, perhaps it was because the potency was too low. And nowadays they have high potency and low potency that they try to use in some of the research, but even the low potency is higher than the high potency that was used in research before. So you really can't even compare the past research. We can talk about it and we can make allusions to it, but we're not really sure if it's equivalent to the potency that you have now.
Yeah, right. To put some numbers to that, in the 1960s, the average potency was about 1% of THC. THC is the active cannabinoid that actually results in the psychological effects, the euphoria. So 1% in 1960, and now the percentages go up to 20 and 25% with apparently an average of around 13%.
Wow.
The potency has risen at the same time that the perception of problems has fallen. And that's an interesting comparison.
Yeah.
Stronger drug, less belief that it could be a problem. So we have to be... we have to go into this with our eyes open.
We're talking about medical marijuana. Our toll-free number is 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeendislands.org. We'll talk more after a quick break. You're listening to The Point. We're talking about medical marijuana with psychiatrist Mark Whaley and psychologist Michael Abbruzzese. Our toll-free number is 866-999-4626. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. So when we're thinking of marijuana, we're visualizing, somebody lighting up the joint. But in fact, many patients ingest this, right?
Yep. They can take a number of different kinds of ways. And again, there's no standardization. So how is that going to be metabolized in the individual system? You just don't know. The variables are just too many to control for.
There are some differences that are known about inhaling it, getting it into the bloodstream through the lungs and getting it into the bloodstream through the stomach. There are important differences to note. With inhaling, the effect comes on within 15 minutes or so, lasts a couple of hours. With taking it in the form of, say, a brownie or something, the effect comes on in about 45 minutes to an hour, slow effect, but lasts much longer. So that might be more appropriate when you're using it for conditions that require long-term maintenance, mm-hmm. for instance, chronic pain, chronic neuropathic pain specifically. Mm-hmm. pain that comes from nervous system origin, that's going to take a longer time. The other thing to keep in mind is sometimes there's bad reactions to side effects, especially to people to the effect rather of marijuana, especially to people who are naive to it. They're the people that are more likely to get the panic attacks and the paranoia, the very unpleasant psychological effects. The good news is most of the time these are temporary and last only a short amount of time. But the naive people, marijuana naive people, are the ones that are more likely to get the bad side effects. And so they're more troublesome if they ingested it because they're going to have the side effects longer.
Yeah. And so basically, this kind of goes back to that all that unknowing stuff is the effects of cannabis consumption really depend on a whole bunch of different factors, like the dose, how you know, the route of administration, the timing, your health, your age, other drugs you might be taking. I mean, there's a whole list of things that play into
and how much marijuana you've used, because there's tolerance that develops to the effects of marijuana.
And that's a real problem in the public perception, which affects why somebody would want to get a certificate for medical marijuana. Most people are just familiar with the medicinal high that you get, and they think it's a drug that gets you high, and there's a part of it that does that. But because of the endocannabinoid system that people have, it touches so many things. So you can get a high on that, but you can also get an upset stomach. Right. People can get very drowsy. They get very relaxed. Well, you don't want to drive because of that. So it touches many, many more things than just getting high. And that's what people don't realize. It's a psychoactive substance, and that seems to be what everyone is focusing on. Right. But it does have very strong biological pluses, minuses.
Yeah, now there is one cannabinoid that doesn't make you high. Mm-hmm. It's called CBD, cannabinol. And that seems to have the most therapeutic possibilities because it seems to be the one that is active on the immune system and also with pain. And does not have the psychological effects. Yeah. So that might turn out to be really useful.
You're answering our listener's question, who says, I've heard that there has been development on cannabis that does not get you high, but retains some of the other desired effects, such as appetite stimulation and smooth muscle relaxing, particularly sought by recovered substance abusers with medical needs who don't want to get high. Have you heard about this? And this is what you're talking about, CBD.
The CBD.
And as a matter of fact, I remember when the ballot question was on, I was at a forum, and there was a man in the audience who talked about the fact that he was taking some of the medicinal marijuana, and he says he ingested it and never got high on it. So this must have been what he was taking.
Probably. Some kind of strain that was heavy in CBD and not so heavy on THC.
Right. So the other interesting thing is cannabinoids have a relatively unique safety record, particularly compared to other therapeutically active substances.
That's right. This is fascinating. Nobody has ever died from a marijuana overdose. So we can safely say that it's not a fatal thing that you can overdose on. A medical body has stated that it basically falls into the same range of any other medication in terms of possible side effects. Everything has side effects. Mm-hmm. And the negative effects from marijuana are really within that acceptable range that we take that we accept for any other prescription medicine.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we're still in the early stages that we've been talking about so far of understanding what kind of side effects are going to have social implications.
Right.
And if it's the psychoactive part of it that has the more dangerous side effects, or if it's the medical, the biological side effects. And just nobody knows yet, because I could conclude that perhaps the law is poorly written. There'll have to be some tweaks to it as we start to get more information to mm-hmm. control for some of these things. But going over some of the research, we do know that about 18% of highway accidents that do not involve alcohol are because of marijuana, and you get high on that. And we do know, because of the reported cognitive side effects, even to beneficial biological effects of the medication, it has lower perceptual abilities. It lowered your cognitive function, lowered your reaction speed. And, of course, that would certainly be implicated in driving a car. And many people may not realize that, but it's the same kind of warning you should probably have on other medications. Don't operate heavy machinery. Don't drive. Right. Be careful about things like that. Now, that stuff is not well known. You can inadvertently be treating yourself for glaucoma or some of the problems connected to MS and you get in a car accident.
That's right.
You have no clue that that was going to happen to you because you weren't prepared for it. And I doubt if they're going to have any warning labels when you buy the plants or the seeds about that.
And the other thing is the police are going to have to come up with some kind of standards for driving while intoxicated with marijuana.
What you mentioned the cognitive function. What about long-term use? There's been some research on IQ?
Well, there's been very little research on that. There's only one major study, and that was done in New Zealand. They had a lot of people, so it was a decent study. But it wasn't done in America. And they concluded that, and they did psychological testing, and they had a cohort that was not tested, and they followed kids who were generally involved in the psychological and the behavioral healthcare system in New Zealand for several decades. So it's a well-designed study. And they found that long-term use of marijuana results in lowered IQ scores. And for most people, a couple of points on an IQ score, that's not big news. And people's IQ scores, because of the properties of IQ tests and how they're designed, people tend to have lower IQ scores as they get older anyway. But the standardization of the test statistically sort of irons that out to make them equivalent in ability and function measurements over time. But under the extreme measures of people who only graduated high school, no college students were involved, you start to see effects in the teenage years of dropping 1, 2, and 3 points every couple of years. So over the course of the study, by the time these students that were tested, they started around age 5, and the last test was around age 38, they had lost an average of 8 points, 8 IQ points. If you're extremely highly intelligent and you're in the very top quartile, 8%, 8 points is not going to make a big difference. But if you're in the so-called statistical average range of an IQ of 100, dropping 8 points will drop you from the 50th percentile down to the 29th percentile. Mm. Well, so it's certainly going to make you eligible for special needs consideration. So if you're functioning in your work and you've been doing marijuana for 30 or 40 years and you started as a teenager and you're a bank president or you're a lawyer or some very high-functioning job, you're going to be losing a little bit off your fastball. Your memory's not going to be so good. Your ability to concentrate is not going to be so good. And you might be wondering why this is. And if you're in your 50s or 60s, you may be thinking it's age-related forgetting, but it may not be that. Or if it is, it's going to be compounded and made worse by the fact that prolonged marijuana use does lower your ability to do well on cognitive tasks.
Right. And it brings up the point that the population that really has to be careful about marijuana is the heavy use population, the teenagers.
Right.
They are the heavy use population, and they're the ones that are most vulnerable to brain damaging effects. It is known, and more is getting developed about this, is people that are kids that are vulnerable to getting schizophrenia, marijuana hastens the process and makes the disease worse. So that's one area. What you just mentioned about memory and cognitive functions, very, very relevant. And I've seen people in my practice that spent their teenage years high on marijuana, essentially, and they didn't progress. They didn't grow up. It's like they had a blank. They were absent for 3 or 4 years. Mm-hmm. And they enter their 20s and maybe they get away from it and try to live a life, and they're not prepared because they've been absent without leave, really, with the marijuana.
Now, it's important to understand what Mark's talking about. It is always one of the side effects of marijuana, whether it's used medicinally or not. You have lowered cognitive functions, memory, attention, cognition, and motivation. And that lasts for several days. So even if you use something on Monday, the average person is still feeling the effects on Friday, maybe Saturday. But the drop in IQ points are pervasive and enduring. So they're more than just a short-term hit. They're a long-term hit.
Right.
So in addition to being a little bit fuzzy short-term, you're also losing ability long-term. That's a really high price to pay.
Exactly.
And it really happens in the teenage years. And smoking, when you start smoking cigarettes in the teenage years too, the biggest damage is done then.
Yep.
Now, when people started smoking as an adult, they did not lose as much off their IQ.
Right.
But teenagers lost a heck of a lot the more they used
it. It's an interesting study. 866-999-4626 if you have comments or questions about medical marijuana. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. Another interesting point, according to some reports, cannabinoids appear to be largely non-toxic to healthy cells and organs, and I think this was in some cancer studies, right?
Yes, right. And, because the debate has been some people have championed outlawing or keeping the outlaw on marijuana because of lung damage, for instance, from the smoking. And that's controversial, whether there really is lung damage. Furthermore, nowadays, you don't have to really smoke it to get the effect, and you can still get it through your lungs. And that's what that vaporization mm-hmm. process is. The vaporization is where the plant, the dried plant, is heated to 180 to 200 degrees, which vaporizes the active chemicals, just makes it into a vapor, which then can be inhaled without any combustion. It doesn't catch on fire. And it's the combustion that is probably responsible for a lot of the lung damaging effects of smoking in general. So there is a safe way of getting it into the lungs, relatively safe, presumably, although this isn't studied very much either. Mm. So it's still an unknown, but common sense would say that it, there's a safe way of getting it into the lungs without undue risk.
So where does the American Medical Association stand on all of this?
Well, that's interesting. They have come out with a statement saying basically that there are short-term studies that indicate positive effects from marijuana for three conditions that they mentioned. Neuropathic pain, which I mentioned before, improving appetite and caloric intake, which already there are drugs approved for that. And it may relieve the spasticity that's associated, muscle spasticity that people with multiple sclerosis get. So it says that these things, there is evidence support of these things. And then it calls for more research. So that's simply, it doesn't really take a stand, except that there's some evidence of positive effect in certain conditions.
Yeah. What about, you know, one of the things when this whole debate was happening is, you know, there was the argument, well, we have other drugs already out there that treat many of these things. But then I go back to that young man I mentioned who talked at that forum, and he said he had tried those other drugs, and they didn't work for him.
Right.
So it would seem that there is at least a small population that medical marijuana is the drug that may work for them.
The best drug without the side effects that happen with other, with other pharmaceuticals, yes.
Yeah. All right, Arthur is giving us a call from the Vineyard. Good morning, Arthur.
Good morning. My question is, what do you think about the Rick Simpson oil, where they're curing people of different types of cancer? By distilling the plant buds to an oil.
And this is a marijuana plant that they're distilling to an oil?
Yeah, Rick Simpson makes oil out of it by using Everclear. They soak it in Everclear and then cook the oil down to a concentrated form, and people ingest it like a gram a day for 60 days, and it helps cure cancers.
I don't think it cures cancer. It might help with the pain, right?
Yeah. Might help with the pain. And actually, there is some evidence that it has some anti-cancer effects, that it blocks some of the growth of cancer cells. There is some evidence for that. Whether you call that a cure is far from established.
Yeah. Right. The cancer research on that is clear, but it's not a large body of research. And
right.
they use it on animal and human cells. So I'm not aware of any large-scale research on individuals that has been standardized. But they do it down the cellular level to look at changes. And again, they do have different applications, but the way they have applied the marijuana and what form they used was not mentioned in the research. But there is some benefit to cancer cell, to treating cancer cells.
Right.
Arthur, thanks for the call. 866-999-4626 is our toll-free number. If you'd like to chime in, that's 866-999-4626. Our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. But most of the medical marijuana used for cancer, would that be for pain or would that be for nausea or both?
Both.
Both.
Both, really.
So it's a chemotherapy,
yeah,
the nausea.
Yeah. There is, like the AMA says, there is evidence that it helps with pain. And there have been studies, at least some, and the majority of the studies show that it does have a positive benefit for various types of pain, even including acute pain from post-surgery, for instance.
Yeah. So I know we were saying there's not a lot of recent research, but are there any chronic pain syndromes that cannabis has been shown to treat more effectively compared to other available medicines? Do we have any research in that area?
Well, they don't name the medicine, but the University of California seems to be in the forefront. They've got 13 or 14 protocols in the pipeline, and they do have some indication that the efficaciousness of of pain and HIV compared to a placebo has been confirmed. But the study that they had when people smoked cannabis, it was effective, but they also, for some reason, they included some other analgesics. So they really have not been able to tease out the active ingredient, whether it was the cannabis or whether it was a combination. I don't know why they did the research that way, but it made it very cloudy. And maybe that's how they were able to get the research funded. But that was some research for HIV. In addition, there have been some people who are doing some work on medical cannabis and sleep, and I've had patients who report that it's really helped their sleep, and I think other therapists and physicians have too, but there's no research on that, no standardized research. The results are not yet in from the University of California.
Yeah. Now, it has been shown in this might be the study you're referring to or maybe others, that it actually does better than standard treatment when treating the neuropathy that's associated, the nerve pain that's associated with
HIV. What do they compare that to? What was the standard treatment they compared that
opioids.
To?
Opioids.
Oh, an opioid, yeah.
Yeah. So it beat that. Yes, the simple answer to your question is yes. There is one condition where it has been compared to accepted treatments.
Boy, one of the things that we're really seeing here is we really need some more research in this area, big time. We're talking about medical marijuana with a psychiatrist Mark Whaley and psychologist Michael Abruzzese. 866-999-4626 is our toll-free number. Our email address is thepoint@capeendislands.org. More after a quick break. You're listening to The Point. We're talking about medical marijuana with psychiatrist Mark Whaley and psychologist Michael Abruzzese. 866-999-4626 is the number to call if you have a comment or question. 866-999-4626, our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. So we talked about some of the IQ issues you could have on the negative side of long-term use in this, but there are some studies that indicate that it can lead to an improvement in cognitive function in some areas, depression, post-traumatic stress.
Well, it really depends, as you're just beginning to specify, what cognitive function are they referring to? The researchers sometimes don't specify, and sometimes researchers, they kind of want to hide some adverse effects, so they'll just group it into like cognitive functioning. So I would probably talk about that in terms of emotional functioning as opposed to pure cognitive function. We've been talking about the negative side effects in terms of memory, cognition, attention, which perhaps can be seen as more purely cognitive than anxiety, depression, and that kind of thing. But certainly a lot of people who even anecdotally have reported using marijuana, they find themselves being very relaxed. They find it helps them put them closer to a meditative state, a very relaxed, restful state, and that's certainly going to have a positive impact on anxiety, stress, and depressive conditions.
Right, exactly. So that might be the route to the improvements that they're talking about there. But again, we're still in the dark.
Yeah. Are there other areas we're finding some positive findings?
Well, there have been some positive findings. We've talked a little bit. I mean, people who have MS, multiple sclerosis, there's always been, even in small studies, there's been consistently positive benefits for people who have MS and the pain syndromes they have there, but they do have the same kind of negative cognitive effects. They're a little bit woozy, their memory's a little bit off, but there has always been something positive for MS patients. And also in glaucoma, it's been repeatedly proven to be helpful in glaucoma, equivalent to some of the other medications they use. But as Mark referred to before, it's very short-acting. Mm-hmm. So if you're going to be smoking marijuana to help your glaucoma condition, you better be smoking 8 or 9 times a day, because you're just not going to be able to get the same kind of bang for your buck as you're going to get from the regular medication. So again, it's helpful, but we don't know if it's going to be any more helpful than what's something else they have out there. So it's helpful for glaucoma. And Mark said before, it can hasten some symptomatology for schizophrenia, but there's some scant research that indicates that it's good for people who have
schizophrenia.
Yeah, right. First-rank symptoms in schizophrenia, it actually does help with their psychosis. Mm-hmm. And we found very, very few drugs that can actually do that. Mm-hmm. So it's helpful for that. There's been one study in 1997 with a synthetic THC that could ease some symptoms of Alzheimer's symptoms, but that has not been replicated. There were some animal studies in what they perceived to be autism, and there's been some helpfulness in autism, but that has not been replicated. So there is some positive there have been some positive results. And something I want to mention to some of our listeners, very few medications, if any, that help with symptoms of Tourette's syndrome. Mm-hmm. But there was one study done a long time ago that marijuana helps with symptoms of Tourette's syndrome. And if that's true, that alone would be worth having legalized marijuana, medicinal marijuana, mm-hmm.
yeah.
because there's
yeah.
really nothing else nothing other else. Than very strong psychotropics to use.
Sure.
One of the other issues of marijuana is often called the gateway drug. What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, that's one of the things that it has as a popular attachment, more or less, and it has driven a lot of political opposition because that's basically a belief. And it's a belief that probably doesn't hold water. Yes, people who do get into opiates, for instance, as addiction, may have started with marijuana. That's very frequent. But not everybody who starts with marijuana, or not even the majority of people who start with marijuana, move on to other things. They can, but they don't necessarily. It's not the drug itself. If the person is predisposed from other factors to be have problems with addiction, they're going to go there, whether they go through marijuana or not. So, is it a gateway drug? Generally, no, but it certainly can serve as that. Even more interesting, though, is some suggestion now that it might be an exit drug, which is really very fascinating. In other words, helping people who are addicted to opiates or alcohol come off. And exit their addiction because it does help with anxiety or can help with anxiety. So there's some evidence there that might be a promising. So
when people talk about a gateway drug, especially in marijuana, I think they're referring to the whole kit and caboodle of environmental behavioral reinforcers. So simply just smoking marijuana, yeah. there's no indication that it's going to make you go into other drugs. But there's a whole culture that has evolved. A lot of people smoke marijuana alone by themselves. Other kinds of drugs, typically it's a more social kind of aspect. As you get to be a teenager, a middle and older teenager, it's more of a party kind of aspect. But when you go into other drugs like heroin or other kinds of things, it's not really a party drug. And you find a lot of people who overdose, they usually someplace in a hotel room or an alley and they've died on their own. So there's a lot of behavioral reinforcers that have to do with social reinforcers, of which marijuana can simply be one, much like alcohol is, much like cocaine was when it first came out several decades ago. So there are a lot of different reasons why people think marijuana could be a gateway drug that are not specifically tied to the drug itself, but more to the environment in which the drug is taken. And it's important to indicate that, to say that most research has been consistent in saying that people who are dependent on marijuana, they tend to be dependent on that particular marijuana. They're not dependent on drugs in general. And the last estimate was that about 3 million people over the age of 12 in America seem to be clinically dependent on their continued use of marijuana. Now, whether they meet the full definition of an addiction is not known, but they tend to be clinically dependent. They get used to it. They want to keep it up.
Right. That's one of the myths, basically, about marijuana that persists, that it is not an addictive drug. That's not true.
Yeah.
It is an addictive drug. And the figures say that about 16% of teenagers who use marijuana will become basically addicted to it. They will suffer physical withdrawal symptoms, mm-hmm. Like irritability, poor sleep, mood changes when they try to come off. And about 9% of adults will fit this definition. They just can't stop. That's what they'll say.
Mm-hmm. Right. And the vast majority of Americans, they don't think that marijuana is harmful at all.
Right.
It depends on how you want to talk about harmfulness. And it in hearing us talk, it makes me think that we're saying that only medical marijuana is all negative. But there are some positive medicinal findings on that. But I think they get confused with the psychoactiveness of the substance, and I think that really muddies the waters. Many people think that there are no negative side effects that are really harmful. Well, as a psychologist, I think if your IQ drops eight points over a couple of decades, I think that's really harmful. If you lose any kind of motivation, if you're going to wind up living in your parents' basement when you're 30 years old, I actually think that's kind of harmful to you as well as to society. Other people may disagree. So there are negative side effects because it does hit our cognitive functioning, our memory, our motivation. It hits our emotions. You know, you're less likely to want to have social interactions with people. You're less likely to want to have any kind of companionship or relationship with other people, similar to what we are seeing with some people who get addicted to gaming. You know, they spend all their time on social media. It tends to make them more depressed and less liable to want to involve themselves with people in one-on-one. So I think those are potentially harmful side effects and negative side effects for for marijuana because of the psychoactive use of the substance. But for the medical aspects, I think there are very promising results.
Mm-hmm. I was going to say, it comes down to that, you know, does it do more harm than good? And right. what your purpose in using it for is. I want to ask you about the issues that are facing doctors, though, with this new law. This law circumvents the FDA approval process for medication. So this is not a prescription, as we mentioned earlier. It's a certificate. So,
right.
Mark, you're a physician who
had to face
has to. Yeah, so tell us what the issues are that are facing
the
doctors.
The only thing that a doctor has to do with this is to certify that this patient has a bona fide medical condition and that it is likely that the harm from using medical marijuana is less than the benefit, or the benefit is greater than the potential harm. That's all he has to say on a letter that the patient then, when the state gets going with their administrative practices, will be able to get a card which will enable that person to go to a dispensary and purchase it. The doctor, this is very different than any other medication. It's not a prescription because you don't prescribe dose, you don't prescribe how often a day. You just say that they are more likely to benefit from it. Then the law delineates what conditions could qualify from cancer, glaucoma, HIV, ALS, which is Lou Gehrig's disease, Crohn's disease, Parkinson's disease, multiple sclerosis, and even hepatitis. But then it has a category of other. So other can be anything.
Anything.
Yeah. So anything that's in the doctor, any condition that the doctor believes at least that the potential benefit is greater than the harm can qualify a patient for having and possessing and growing marijuana.
So dose, how often, the patient decides that?
The patient is on the hook for that. They manage the effects and side effects without any doctor input.
Mm. And so even if you go to the dispensary, you also decide whether you're going to take the ingested kind or if you're going to smoke it. Or
and what strain.
We have the different potencies and things, and
right.
there are different cannabinoids, like we're mentioning THC, but there's a whole bunch of different ones.
Right.
So as the patient, how do you know?
They're going to have to rely on the
trial
salespeople.
And error.
And trial
sales
and error.
People.
Yeah.
Wow.
Well, the trial and error method is age old. People always try things to see what's going to help. If that's the looseness with which the law has been written, then it really puts, I think, end users, the patients, in a heck of a position, because that puts them right on the front line. Other than showing a police officer or someone your card, your letter from your physician, it would seem to be up to the law enforcement officials as to whether or not how much you have in your possession or when the card was written. Whether that you have been running afoul of the law. It really becomes a legal issue. So I think that's a very extensive kind of side effect, social side effect for our society and our community, because that could burden the courts. That could make a lot of confusion for the police officers.
It already is, yeah.
Right, and it already is. And it can be a lot of problems for the families. And I don't think there's enough publicity for the community to understand what kind of hot water it can put people in who are totally unsuspecting and don't have any idea how innocently they can get dragged into some very serious legal side effects.
Yeah. And again, it's we don't have this a form yet, right? It's just a letter from the doctor. We don't have an actual form.
The doctor just writes a letter. Some attorneys have come up with a form, but the state hasn't approved one.
And again, we mentioned no FDA approval, so because there's no science establishing,
safety and efficacy.
Yeah, and no data on ways to measure, no standardization of the product.
Right.
So we really have a lot to learn here.
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely.
All right. A question from a listener says, does marijuana cause amotivational behavior or do amotivated people tend to be attracted to it?
Well, there's no research on that because there's no money for that kind of research, interesting though it may be. But I think the research that we do have always mentions the fact that people tend to have a lowered motivation and some relaxation, some lethargy, and lowered cognitive effects such as memory, cognition, and attention. So that's always been reported as a side effect, even when the medical marijuana usage is successful for any kind of pain or gastrointestinal problem. So yes, it does do that. And does that mean amotivational people are going to be attracted to it? Typically not. Amotivational people tend to lose their motivation to be attracted to much of anything, and they would have to be persuaded to do that. So if you are really clinically depressed, chronically depressed, there's not a lot of interest you have in doing anything, so you're not really at risk for making yourself more depressed by taking marijuana, because that is probably not the the protocol that's going to be attractive to you. If you do take some marijuana and you have some guidance and supervision, you may find that the emotional side effects, such as anxiety, depression, may start to alleviate. And that may be replaced by low motivation down the road, but that's too hard to tease out from depression at this mm-hmm. point.
And I've seen in my practice over the years that people do use marijuana to treat panic problems and depressive problems. And then when they get on effective treatment, accepted treatment, their use of marijuana fades. Mm-hmm. They just don't need it anymore and don't want it, probably because of this amotivational risk. It's a risk. Amotivation is a risk.
Mm-hmm. We've been talking a lot about the effect on the developing brain in teenagers. And so I'm assuming that in these 22 states, this is not approved for children. This is adults, right?
No, it is.
It is? It's approved for children?
Yes, it is approved for children in Massachusetts. However, it's with some guidelines. What gets approved as a caretaker, a parent basically, is the possessor of the certificate and supposed to manage the supply. But it is approved for some things in children. If you saw Sanjay Gupta CNN program on marijuana, you'll be very convinced of seeing a little girl, 4 years of age or something, that her parents moved to Colorado in order to get marijuana so they could treat her intractable seizures. Mm. And you see that on TV, the seizing, and then right, yeah. and then how good she is after getting the drug. You get convinced pretty easily, at least based on one case.
Right. And there's evidence that medical marijuana is helpful for epilepsy and seizures as well.
Yes.
That's right.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Yeah.
So how are doctors reacting to this? When you talk to your fellow doctor, I mean, I'm sure there'll be some are going to say, I'm not going to do this.
Oh, yeah.
And they don't have to, right?
They don't have to. They're just invited to do it. Now, I think most doctors probably will not get involved here. One thing I think should be pointed out is one of the problems with the law has to do with supply. The law allows an individual to have up to a 60-day supply, which is defined as 10 ounces. When studies are done, what's characterized as a heavy user will use only 4 ounces of marijuana over 60 days, a heavy user.
Hmm.
Whereas like a medium user might use 2. So let's say you have a medium user who uses 2 ounces, but he has 8 ounces left, more or less, over 60 days. If they want to go into a little business, they can. Right now, the price of marijuana goes for about $400 an ounce. So that's $3,200 every 60 days, which comes up to over $19,000 a year.
But that wouldn't be legal. He can't legally sell that.
Well, it depends, because he could legally sell it to other people with marijuana cards.
Oh, if they had the card, I got
yeah.
you. Yeah.
Yeah.
Wow.
Because they're allowed to have it. There's problems here.
We have some gray areas.
Yeah, we have some definite gray areas.
You could also sell it to people in different states who have more liberal marijuana laws.
Possibly.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow. Just briefly, in the minute or so we have left, there's some stock exchange going
right.
on this?
There's a part of the this is a very political and social and medical condition. We're talking about medical marijuana. It's also financial, because there are some stocks, there are companies that went in business trying to make money off this. And there are some people who want to add medical marijuana stocks to their portfolio. And people should be very wary about that, because the majority of stocks, even the biggest ones out there, they're all losing money and they don't have any profits to report. They have no business model. They have no product. It's like the internet bubble of years ago. So be very, very careful when you think maybe you can cash in on this. I mean, if you have 8 ounces of marijuana, you may be able to sell it in California or Colorado for $3,200, but that does not mean you can make money off a medical marijuana stock, and I'm not sure when that might be possible, if ever.
Yeah. So again, if you're considering this, you want to have a conversation perhaps with your doctor about
right.
both the pros and the cons
yes.
Before you
yeah.
sign up.
Go into it with open eyes.
All right. Dr. Michael Abbruzzese and Dr. Mark Whaley, thank you both, as always.
You're welcome.
You.
I'm Indy Todd. Thank you for listening.
Amy Vins produces The Point, with assistance from Jenny Junker. The executive producer is Mindy Todd. Music by Benjamin Verdery and William Coulter. The Point is a production of the Cape and Islands NPR stations, a service of WGBH.